want kicking things out of orbit?
Oh my gosh!
I'm gonna just knock it forward.
One of the greatest fighters.
John Jones beat every champion. Pretty much
that limit. Khabib gets his hands on McGregor gonna be that night.
Let's get into it.
Hello! You are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from UFC 256. Figueiredo versus Moreno. I will do all of this with one half. Some would argue the better half of the Fight Night Picks preview show. I'm speaking, of course, of the great Matt Allen. Matt, how are you?
Great, John. Really great card last night. Excited to finally get to kind of break it down and talk about it after the fact.
Yeah, you know, let me tell you how good the card was last night, Matt. I watched some prelims, so the folks in the comments should be excited. Matt, I never want to take away from what we got. By talking about what we lost, but it gives context. Let's talk about some of the moving pieces of last night's card and discuss your feelings coming into the card. So at the top, we have Amanda Nunes and Megan Anderson falling out. We lost Kamaru Usman and Gilbert Burns. We lost Carlos Sparza and Amanda Ribas. Marvin Vettori and Omer Akhmadov. Akhmadov withdrew. We lost Dwight Grant and Jianglian Li. We lost Vettori and Jacare. We lost Petr Yan and Aljamain Sterling. We lost Tisha Torres and Angela Hill. We lost a lot. So, and there was more. We lost a lot. I say all this to say, what do you think about, how'd you feel about the card as it ended up shaking out?
Did Omer Akhmadov missing out on this fight secretly crown our fighter of the year? Because it's really weird. Just him getting taken out of this, so that forces Marvin Vettori to find a new opponent. They give him Jacare, a fight that everyone's really excited for. And then, of course, Darren Till can't fight Jack Hermanson. So then everything gets switched around. And really, like, Kevin Holland should send Omari Akhmadov flowers or something, because the fact that Akhmadov withdrew really set everything into motion. I will be honest, though. I'm more excited for Kamaru Usman versus Gilbert Burns than most people. I think that fight is absolutely phenomenal. And I do think Burns is one of the few guys who's going to be able to give Usman big problems. So I'm a little disappointed about that, but when you look kind of through the rest of the fights, other than the Piotr Jan, Aljamain Sterling, not a lot of those fights are real needle movers in the grand scheme of things. Of course, Amanda Nunes being champ, one of the GOATs, that kind of sucks to miss out on, but like, we both know how her and Megan Anderson's going to go. It's going to be a short fight. It's not going to be a competitive fight. So although we did miss out on some really good fights, on some what we'd probably consider a year-end fight card quality, I'm still really excited with what we got. I mean, the main event delivered a lot more than I think most people ever anticipated it would. So all in all, like you said, it's really hard to complain about what we got in the end.
Well, and to use your analogy and push it even further, do you think that if Marvin Vettori beats Omari Akhmadov, we're talking about him in title contention? We're talking about him, like, the way we're talking about Vettori now, is there some people quietly talking about he should get the Adesanya rematch? That doesn't happen if he beats Akhmadov. So, you know, I don't think there's a lot of talk for that, but I think he's certainly further along than he would have been had he just fought Akhmadov. Maybe even if he had just fought Jacare. All right, let's move on to the fights, Matt. From the rubble and remains of the flyweight division, it seems as if a star has emerged. After a little stumble with his weight in the first fight with Joseph Benavidez, it has been smooth sailing for Figueiredo. He won the fight easily, the rematch easily, and his last fight less than a month ago with Alex Perez, easily. And then along came an assassin, Brandon Moreno, who was on a run of his own. His last four are a draw with Askar Askarov, followed by wins over Carl France, Formiga, and Royval. So these guys, these are the guys, Matt. These are the guys to decide who's the man at 125 pounds. Last night it was a back-and-forth fight throughout, a fight of the year candidate for sure. But when it was all said and done, the official result read a majority draw, 47-46 for Figueiredo, and then two 47-47s. So, Matt, I'll ask you first if you agree with the decision, and then expand upon that to what you saw in this fight.
Okay, so I saw a lot of people were upset that it only really became a draw because one of the judges in the fifth round gave it to Brandon Moreno. I got to be honest, that's as entertaining and as close of a fight as you can possibly have. If you are going to judge it round by round, honestly, I did think Figueiredo won even with the point deduction. But like, Brandon Moreno showed us stuff that we never even thought he had in him. Yes, he's always been that entertaining fighter. You can really match him up with whoever, and he is going to put on a really good show. But I know I was really questioning whether he was ready for a fighter like Devison Figueiredo, and especially in the year 2020. We talk about fighter of the year, you know, Kevin Holland, we're going to talk about him in a bit. Devison Figueiredo, I know he missed weight in that first title attempt, if you will, But he's had as good and as dominant of a year as any fighter. And the fact that Brandon Moreno was able to rise to that occasion and really test Devison Figueiredo like we haven't seen since the Juicy A Formiga fight. And I do think that's a really interesting fight to go back to constantly, because when you keep on reading the keywords as to why Figueiredo lost the fight against Formiga in the first place, it was, oh, the weight cut was really hard. And, you know, I just wasn't really as prepared for that fight. He's openly said that with the new money and the resources that he has from being the flyweight champ, he's been able to invest a lot of that money back into himself, be that with nutritionists due to his weight cutting, be that with his training and whatnot. So we're seeing the best version of Devison Figueiredo right now. And the fact that Brandon Moreno was able to go out there and not only make it competitive throughout five rounds, but really put it on Figueiredo at some point, I thought it was an extremely impressive performance by both guys. I really think Figueiredo proved, and I do think he needed one of these fights to really show us how good is Devison Figueiredo, to quote the great Chael Sonnen. Because, listen, it's easy for people to get on your bandwagon when you're knocking everyone out in the first round and you're guillotining everyone in the first round. But when you have one of these knock-em-down, drag-em-out wars with a guy like Brandon Moreno, that's how you become a star in the long run. And I'm not going to stand here and say that I think Devison Figueiredo is going to be the next big star in the UFC. But if he can keep on having fights like this and keep on putting performances on like he has throughout the rest of 2020, Devison Figueiredo is going to be around for a very long time. And he's going to be a guy who's going to be holding UFC gold for a long time. And then just over to Brandon Moreno quick. Brandon Moreno, one of the more impressive, really just UFC runs when you look at it as a whole. He had that Ultimate Fighter run that a lot of people sort of forget about. It was the year when they brought on all these regional champs because they were like, okay, we have to find someone to fight Demetrius Johnson. Of course, Tim Elliott ended up winning. But Brandon Moreno, the last pick, gets cut from the UFC, never stopped believing in himself the whole entire time. And then you look at him now. He is fighting neck and neck with one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the world. I thought it was a phenomenal main event. But my last point about this, I don't think this is fight of the year. I think we can easily point to two different fights that are better than this one. I do think Dan Hooker, Dustin Poirier was a better fight. And I do think the Joanna Jacek, Weili Zhang fight was also a little bit better. So I think this is in kind of your top five for fight of the year, but I'm not sure if this takes the cake.
Future champ 2021. Let's go, Moreno. Let's go.
That's Craig Allen FTP tells you who his favorite flyweight is.
He can't just let us have our time. He can't. He killed him. You know what? I'll say this, Matt. I'm going to push back against even myself in the next point I'm going to bring up. A lot of times we see, and first let me say I agree with you on fight of the year. A lot of times what we see is a fighter will overperform what we thought he was going to do. And by overperforming, and listen, the right guy was in the booth last night for this narrative to be created, which was Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan's famous for taking a narrative and running with it. A lot of times when a guy overperforms in the early part of a fight, we'll just paint the narrative of the whole fight that way and say, well, you know, he must have won because, you know, he did better than we thought he was going to do. Well, doing better than we thought you were going to do does not equate to winning. So for me, I think that my pushback to those who think that Moreno won, and I'm not saying that he lost necessarily. I'm just saying here's the pushback to those who think he won. Can we really say that overperforming and also just, I'm a big fan of this. If I hear over 20 times how great of a chin you have in a fight, you're getting cracked. You're just surviving it, right? So Devison Figueiredo was putting it on Brandon Moreno. He was just surviving it. A man with a lesser chin would have been out there much earlier. So, you know, the chin he's born with, there's nothing you can do about that. So as far as the performance goes, I do think he took his foot off the gas in the fifth. If he was going to win it, I would have wanted to see a more impressive fifth. But, you know, Figueiredo was sick, and you know, I'm a very big proponent of once you step in there, all excuses go out the window. So he showed up, he performed well. I think that, and we've talked in the past about, does everybody have that signature win where they're pushed? Last time out, we mentioned Adesanya and Gastelum. We mentioned Vettori and Hermanson. Obviously, Figueiredo's already got the belt around his waist, but this is one of the first big tests that really, like, you know, he had to dig down. Jones and Gustafson is going into the Hall of Fame as a fight for the fact of how far Gustafson pushed Jones. So I think this was that kind of fight. So I guess my question to you is two. One, have we settled who the man is at 125 because we had a draw? And two, is Moreno more than just a guy with a great chin?
I do think he's more than just a guy with a great chin. And I'm going to go a little outside the cage for this one. Brandon Moreno kind of has the it factor. And I think that, listen, you can say what you want about UFC embedded. Sometimes the episodes are good. Sometimes they aren't. I really thought they did a good job marketing Brandon Moreno this week. He's a guy who hasn't got a lot of shine in the past. I know he main evented against Sergio Pettis before he got cut, but not really. Brandon Moreno's not a household name. I like how the UFC promoted him. He's a fun guy. And I'm going to quote Wreck-It Ralph on this one. You can be a bad guy, but are you really a bad guy? And I think Brandon Moreno represents that. When he gets into the cage, he is violent. He is looking to hurt you. But then you look at him outside, and he's just like a regular dude. He collects Legos and Funko Pops. Like, if you look at Brandon Moreno and you look at his fighting style and sort of the intangibles that he has outside the cage, I think he always will be more than just a guy at 125. And I mean, gee, the fact that he had a fight of the year quality fight with a guy who is pound for pound top 15, I think does prove that. The real question is, I don't know if I want to see Brandon Moreno in a rematch immediately. I know everyone's calling for that. I know Dana White's been calling for that. But other than like Henry Cejudo fighting Deiveson Figueiredo, there's not a lot of guys right now. So you might have to go back with Moreno since it was a draw. But I would like to see Moreno keep on developing further. Because right now we see every single time he goes out there, he fights better. He adds a new little wrinkle to his game. So I would like to see Brandon Moreno continue to improve, because I truly do think one day he will be able to get over the Deiveson Figueiredo hub. And maybe that is Figueiredo slows down a little bit. Maybe the weight cut gets to him at a certain point where his performances will start to be diminished because of it. But no, I definitely think Brandon Moreno is going to be a guy who's going to be top five for the next 2-3 years at a minimum.
Well, here's where it gets interesting. And the next thing I'm going to ask you is, what do you want next for both of these guys? But I guess where it gets interesting is there's two different case studies here for what you're talking about. There's the case study of how quickly it seemed like Amanda Nunes and Valentina Shevchenko fought each other. And then once they fought each other, it was kind of like, we can't go back to that well, because Amanda won a couple of times and that was that. You could use Joanna Jędrzejczyk and Claudia Gajelia as an example of the same thing. Then you have on the other side of the coin, John Jones and Alexander Gustafsson. And we waited so long to do that rematch that they weren't really even in the same headspace when the rematch happened, both career-wise, for a lot of different reasons. So sometimes you want to just say, all right, you guys had a hell of a fight. Take the things that you learned about each other, go back to the gym, and we'll see you in 3 months. And stay in that same headspace so that we can get a good fight again. The problem, like you said, is if Deiveson Figueiredo wins the second one, it's a hard sell for the third fight. And Moreno may, in fact, be a better fight when the third fight would come around. So with all that being said, what do you want for both of these guys next?
Okay, so I'm going to kind of go against what I just said. They are probably going to do the rematch. Again, it was a draw and a title fight. I'd be very surprised they don't go back to Brandon Moreno. I do think that we aren't asking the question enough of, when's Deiveson Figueiredo good enough to come back? Like, there was the pictures that came out of him wrapped up going to the hospital. Fights like this don't normally call for a really quick rebound, so I would like to see both guys take quite a bit of time off. I know it's hard to say because they are two of the more active guys we've seen in 2020, but I would like to see both guys take a meaningful period of time off. Brandon Moreno, if he doesn't get the Figueiredo fight, I would love to either see the Askarov rematch. I know that was the draw the first time around, Askarov's first fight in the UFC. Brandon Moreno's return to the UFC, of course. Phenomenal fight for as long as it lasted. Another fight I'd like to see, I need to see Brandon Moreno beat Alejandro Pantoja at some point in his life. I saw him lose him on The Ultimate Fighter. I saw him lose him his last fight in the UFC before he got cut. This is a very different fighter. And with Pantoja coming off a loss, we very well might be able to see it. But for Figueiredo, it's really odd, because right now at 125, we've sort of been building Brandon Moreno up over this last year of, well, he beat Kai Kara France, so that's kind of the first step. Then he beat Jussier Formiga, and it's like, oh, damn, like, is Brandon Moreno ready to fight for the title? With Figueiredo, it doesn't really seem like there's that next thing in line. Maybe they do go to Askarov, they don't end up giving him to Moreno, but he's already beaten so many of the top guys, and he's beaten so many of them really impressively that it's really either move up to 135 or fight Brandon Moreno again. I truly believe that's what it is for Figueiredo.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, unless they can coax Henry Cejudo out of retirement, I think that, like you said, the thing I like about the Askarov fight for Moreno is they got unfinished business because the first fight was a draw. And what you do is you just play the winner gets Figueiredo game. You know, if you were open to an immediate rematch for Moreno anyway, then just say, all right, let's see if we really have what we think we have in this kid. Put him back out there against Askarov. And then, like you said, I think that you're losing a fight between those two if you don't match them up before they would eventually go to fight Figueiredo. So I like that a lot. All right, Matt, let's move on to the co-main event. The co-main event, it was the past versus perhaps the future. Tony Ferguson was untouchable for the better part of 6 years, but now he has seemed to come back to earth a little. He was in the fight. He was in the fight with Justin Gaethje, but the clear loser for Du Bronx. He's been cooking for the last 2 years with impressive performances. However, the level of competition hasn't been the highest as far as I'm concerned. So Tony Ferguson marks a severe raise in competition, and he handled it like gangbusters. The fight was never really in doubt as Oliveira cruised to a unanimous decision victory with 30-26s all over the cards. So the immediate question always is, what'd you see? But I want to talk about that from a different perspective, which, you know, we're talking about the Dana White 60, who stays and who goes. So I guess when I'm watching this fight, the real question for me is Ferguson washed, or is Charles Oliveira just starting to figure things out? And I know that we hate to take away the shine from the guy that wins. They made a huge point of saying that last night on the broadcast. Oliveira looked amazing, but it's just hard to believe that he would do that against a version of Tony Ferguson that isn't well past his prime or you know, out to sea or however you want to put it. What'd you see, and what do you think's going on?
Okay, the co-main event was one of the weirdest fights ever. And I, for full transparency, I predicted Tony Ferguson to win. I thought he was going to go out there, get Oliveira up against the cage, and do what Tony does best, start throwing crazy combinations. I think something that Ferguson doesn't get enough credit for is he's extremely heavy-handed at 155. We all know him for the submissions and the scrambling and, you know, the wild, fun fights. But Tony Ferguson can crack. And with a guy like Charles Oliveira, we've seen it before. And I didn't believe it until last night. And Daniel Cormier was harping on this a lot, but I think I do agree with him. The weight cut at 145 made it so that when Charles Oliveira did get into a hard fight, he was in there. But when the going got really tough, he couldn't hit that extra gear because he was just so depleted. Charles Oliveira, 155, I really do think can become world champ. And I've got this weird scale. I don't know what award I'm going to start giving it out to. But, you know, sometimes you look at the rankings, and I know the rankings don't make any sense, but you look at the rankings and you go, okay, number 11 is a really hard matchup for the champ. I just don't really know how he gets there in the first place. I always felt like that for Charles Oliveira and Khabib. Not saying he would beat Khabib by any means, but he does offer a really unique challenge to a guy like Nurmagomedov. I just never knew how he was going to get to that title shot in the first place. But, oh my God. Like what he did to Tony Ferguson, that fight wasn't even competitive. The wrestling of Oliveira looked phenomenal. And again, it's something we don't talk about a lot with Ferguson. Ferguson was a collegiate wrestler. He's a very good one at that. So that Charles Oliveira was able to just go out there, body lock, takedown, take him down at will, was really, really impressive. And I don't know if Tony Ferguson is washed. And to get back to that Dana 60 or 80, I don't think Tony Ferguson's going to be leaving the UFC anytime soon. I think Cowboy Cerrone can lose 4 in a row. I think Tony can probably lose 2 to 2 of the better lightweights in the world. But for Tony Ferguson, and Craig and I were talking about this before we got filming, I'm kind of glad he fought Oliveira in this fight. Because if that was the version of Tony Ferguson, let's say they decided, okay, Dustin Poirier, you're fighting Tony Ferguson. That'll either co-main event a pay-per-view or be like the main event of a really good fight night. Like Dustin hurts that version of Tony Ferguson. I do think Tony needs time to either settle with his coach or just kind of settle into the fact that maybe he isn't going to get that Khabib fight ever. And maybe he isn't going to win titles anymore. But I do think Tony Ferguson could be in the top 15 and a lot of competitive fights, a lot of really good fighters. Just the question does come down to, what does his skill set match up with nowadays? I know he beat Kevin Lee, but when you look at the Kevin Lee fight, and that's the one that I watched a lot in preparation for this, Kevin Lee did mount Tony Ferguson in about 30 seconds when they were on the ground. Like, Tony has really good grappling, but when he fights these other guys who are sort of grappling specialists, if you will, the Charles Oliveiras, who, you know, he's got that one touch, one kill jiu-jitsu. We saw that at the end of the first round. Lesser men would attack to that armbar that really I don't even want to talk about. That was one of the grossest armbars you're ever going to see someone not tap from. For Tony, I don't think this is the end of the road. I think there's a lot of fun fights out there. I'd really like to see him fight like a Paul Felder. I know Paul Felder's coming off a loss. Tony Ferguson's coming off two of them. It would just be one of those fun fights for the fans. And it's two guys who we don't really know what they're fighting for anymore. With Tony, is he ever going to get back to a title shot? Is he just going to be that fun guy at 155? And with Paul Felder, is he a commentator? Is he a fighter? I think it's a fight that both guys would accept. And it does kind of tell you where they both are in their career. But just for the sake of this one, I don't think Tony Ferguson is washed. But I would start to wonder about it going forward. So if he does lose the next one, then maybe I'll jump on that boat. But I just think Charles Oliveira was the better fighter last night.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the context matters for everything. And the context of this fight is that in the book, and for history's sake, it's always going to go down as a 30-26 unanimous decision. That doesn't tell the story because if Oliveira hits that armbar in any other part of that round, it's a wrap. So we could very easily be having a conversation about why did Charles? Because Charles Oliveira found the armbar. Tony's just too stubborn to tap to it. So, you know, if we're talking about Charles Oliveira beating Tony Ferguson in the first round by armbar, are we looking at Tony Ferguson differently? I mean, we have to almost. I think, you know, I like the matchups you talked about, and I'll pin you down on somebody here, but you already kind of touched on, you don't think that Ferguson's going to get cut. I don't think he's going to get cut either. But, you know, here's a guy who tweets champ shit only, and he kind of, that's the path he's been on. And he hasn't done a lot of losing over the last 6 or 7 years. So I think it's going to be interesting. You know, Cowboy Cerrone was able to rebrand himself and still go after, you know, find things to keep his interest in this division. Some guys can and some guys can't. I'm interested to see if Tony Ferguson likes being the guy that spoils Dana's plans and likes going against the guys that Dana feels great about and ruining their chances. He can make a lot of money doing that for the next couple of years. It's just a matter of whether he wants to do it or not. So what do you think's next for both these guys?
So for Charles Oliveira, he's probably going to get matched up with the winner of Dustin and Connor, which is the weirdest thing to say, because, like, is Charles Oliveira the smallest name opponent Conor McGregor's ever had? I couldn't really imagine, like, the press conferences behind that. You just have a really nice Brazilian guy and an Irish guy who's going to be yelling a lot of profanities. Matchmaking-wise, that makes sense. But right now, Charles Oliveira, he's done a great thing. He's in what you'd kind of consider the big three right now. And we're not talking about the Celtics near the end of the 2000s. It's more, you always have those three guys who are near a title. So you have the champ normally, and for the longest time, as an example, you had Conor, Khabib, and Tony. It was, okay, Conor can come in and fight whoever he wants to. Tony's the rightful number one contender. Khabib's the champ. You kind of match those three up however. And then we had sort of transitioned to, well, Gaethje, Dustin, and Khabib were. Well, we got rid of Khabib. I don't think it's crazy to say Charles Oliveira is now in that big three of Dustin Poirier, Justin Gaethje, and now Charles Oliveira. Because with Conor, it's kind of hard to have him in the division. I know he is fighting Dustin next month, but I do think Charles Oliveira, he's right up there with anyone. So for him, you could either fight Michael Chandler or the winner of Poirier-Connor. And that would be the only fight I take if I'm him. If I'm Charles Oliveira, I just beat Tony Ferguson, one of the best lightweights of all time. And even if you do think Tony is past his prime, and he very well could be. Again, I don't believe he is, but it will kind of take that next fight to show that. But for Oliveira, you just beat one of the more well-known guys, a guy who has headline pay-per-views, a very recognizable name in the sport. You can only be looking forward. I really hope they don't offer Charles Oliveira, like, hey, you want to fight Dan Hooker at a main event on a fight night? That would just be terrible to do to the poor guy. So hopefully Oliveira, he's either in that number one contender fight, or he's fighting for a title next. Those are the only two things left for him. And for Tony, yeah, fight like an ally, Quinta. Fight a Paul Felder. Fight one of those guys who they're going to give you a really entertaining fight, but it's a super winnable fight. And then from there, we can judge where you are in their career. Because if Tony Ferguson loses to Paul Felder, and again, this is not an insult towards Paul Felder, but if he loses to Felder, that's probably it for Tony Ferguson, really even in the top 10 as a guy who can just sort of stick around. But if he can beat Paul Felder, and then let's say he can move up the ranks and fight like a Dan Hooker. And if he can beat Dan Hooker too, then we are talking about Tony Ferguson back up near the top of the division. So I do think matchmaking for both guys can be really important going forward. But in my ideal world, I've got Oliveira fighting the winner of Connor and Dustin, and I've got Ferguson fighting Felder next.
Yeah, I think we're going to find out a lot about what the UFC thinks about Charles Oliveira by who they match him up against next. You know, if like you said, if it's Dan Hooker, I don't think they're going to, you know, I mean, I would be interested to see him fight Michael Chandler. I just don't think that's how you bring Chandler into the UFC. So what they do with Oliveira, again, is going to tell us a lot about what they see, what kind of future they see for him. All right, let's move on. Let's talk Mackenzie Dern and Verena Jandiroba. Unanimous decision win for Dern here. The thing that stuck out to me, and I'm going to be real short with this one because I really want to get to Kevin Holland. But the thing that fascinates me about this fight is that Dern really looks to be wanting to establish herself as a striker, almost to a fault in this one. So what'd you see in this fight? I mean, Dern looks like she has enough to defeat someone on Jandiroba's level when she's preoccupied, and she really seemed preoccupied with the striking. What'd you see here?
I really like how you broke that down, actually. And for the longest time, Craig and I did harp on Mackenzie Dern for a long time. She just never really seemed to be improving. She would throw those crazy looping shots. If one landed, that was great. And then we all know what her bread and butter is. That jiu-jitsu, she really is the female Damian Maia right now in the UFC. And Verena Jandiroba, again, it's a former Invicta champ. You are going to learn quite a bit from beating a woman like that. And the fact that Mackenzie Dern was able to beat her without really doing the thing that she's most comfortable with, I really like what we are seeing from Dern. I do think that she is starting to turn that corner and start to develop more as an MMA fighter and not just as a jiu-jitsu player who is now adding MMA components to their game. I really like the fact that she's training with Jason Perillo, too. One of the better guys you can go to for striking. it is just really interesting. I don't know where Mackenzie Dern's ceiling is right now. I don't know what style of a fighter we're even going to see in the next 2 years, because if she is going to stay on this path of, I'm going to start outstriking my opponent, then we might start seeing a Bangkok ready Mackenzie Dern under Jason Perillo, working behind the jab, using her cardio. That would actually be kind of nice to see. Or are we going to see a Mackenzie Dern, and this is the ideal version, who's going to go out there, shoot those body lock takedowns, try to get the fight to the mat, use her ground and pound to then open up submission. If I was her coach, that's probably how I would go about things. But again, there's a reason I'm sitting here and not currently in Mackenzie Dern's gym. And for Verna Jandihova, again, your only two losses are to Mackenzie Dern and Carla Esparza on short notice. She's going to be around the division for a really long time. And losing a fight like this to Mackenzie Dern doesn't really diminish her value at all.
Yeah, you know, I think that it depends on how long the long game Mackenzie Dern's playing is. And, you know, she's a relatively young fighter. She's 27. I think she's, you know, in the since her fighting career's started, she lost some time, I think, because she had a baby. So, like, she, to me, if she's looking at her fighting career as, I don't want to be Ronda Rousey in the sense that I want to turn myself into a complete mixed martial artist so that when I get to the championship levels, I have a wide skill set to draw from, then I have a lot of respect for that. If she is a self-hating jiu-jitsu player and wants to now turn herself into a striker, if she's working with Perillo, she likes what she's doing with Perillo, and she's like, okay, I need to try this with live bullets. Like, I need to try my striking in fights, not just in the gym. And I need to not go in there and just rely on what comes easily to me. Then I respect it. I mean, she, listen, for a jiu-jitsu fighter, she's a grimy striker. She likes a dirty fight. And I can respect that about her. So if she's playing the long game in terms of making herself very diverse, then I have a lot of respect for it. And I think she may be. So what do you like both for next? What do you like next for both of these fighters?
It is really interesting. For Verna, you don't really know where to place her. Personally, I'd like to see if Macy Barber returns anytime soon. I think that could be a really fun fight. Kind of depends if Barber comes back at 125 or 115. For Mackenzie Dern, it's odd because you look at her one loss and it was to Amanda Hibas, who, I mean, Amanda Hibas is kind of the next big thing at 115. She does look like she could be a future title challenger. I think Mackenzie Dern is ready for those bigger names in the division. I don't want to see her get matched up with like Ioane and Jacek next. That would just completely get rid of her hype, really, and kind of halt whatever she does have going. But for Mackenzie Dern, again, I'm sort of drawing a blank on who she can fight. I think a Claudia Delia matchup would be really fun. I would like to see her start to fight sort of the lower end of the elite in the division. So Claudia would be a really fun one. And for Verna Jandihova, it's interesting. You're a little bit later on in your career. You've accomplished so many great things outside the UFC. I always find it odd when someone is a champion outside the UFC and they are starting to get some losses to maybe not the highest level of competition in their division, because you have to think their mindset is, I was the former Invicta champ. I am one of these elite of the elite. And when you are losing to Mackenzie Dern, and I guess not Carla Esparza, but anyone's going to lose to her, it's always interesting to see how a fighter like that rebounds. So for Mackenzie Dern, I'd love to see the Claudia fight. For Verna, maybe they match up with the Tisha Torres quick, just because Torres looks so good against Sam Hughes. And I know we're going to talk about that one in a little bit. It's not like Sam Hughes is the highest level of competition. So maybe that could be a matchup in the future. I'm curious to see who you would like both to get matched up with.
I agree. I mean, I agree with everything you said. I like the Gedalia fight because I want to see somebody, not who's better than Dern or Dern's equivalent on the floor, but someone that would make it hard for Dern to submit her. Like who's you know, skilled enough on the floor to stay out of submissions, but is a horrible matchup on the feet. To just see where, give Dern an idea of where she's really at on the feet. I like that that matchup a lot. And as far as Jandihova goes, I don't get overly obsessed with fighters that are that lost. So whoever you said is fine with me. All right, Matt, let's move on to who may be one of the. Listen, I'm going to tell the audience the story of Kevin Holland using Dana White's quotes, courtesy of Sure Dog. He's a talented guy and he won his fight, but he won't shut up. The entire fight, he was talking to me the whole fight, White said. This guy's coming in, he's talking shit the entire fight. So I said, I'm not signing this guy. I don't want him. I'm not interested. This is after Holland appeared on the Dana White Contender Series. Thiago Santos fight falls out, and I said, let's call some contender guys that we liked. They all turned down the fight. I said, call Big Mouth. I want to see if Big Mouth takes this fight. Well, he took the fight. So, Matt, Big Mouth wrote checks on Saturday night. His ass cashed him. Kevin Holland 1 minute was on the bottom with Jacare, saying he had a dream about that moment. And the next minute, he hit Jacare so hard, Jacare thought he was back in Strikeforce or in another promotion, which he might soon be. The result reads, Kevin Holland defeated Jacare Souza by knockout, 145 of round one. You know, here's my question for you. We're going to give Holland his flowers. But my question to you is, does he get a couple roses or does he get a whole bouquet for this performance? What do you want?
Back at the Brinks truck and give him everything. Kevin Holland is my MVP of the night. And not just because of, again, what he did in the cage. The promo that he cut for why he should fight Chimaev and what's now 6 days from now was amazing. I loved everything Kevin Holland did. And I like how the quote that you had brought up about him being the big mouth, the UFC had played that quite a bit. They were like, oh, he's cocky, he's young. He can back it up, though. And there's nothing Dana White loves more than someone who can do the promoting job for him and can also back it up inside the cage. And again, for full transparency, I picked Jacare to win this fight. I thought Jacare was going to get him down to the mat. I think Jacare is super underrated wrestling. We did see a little bit of that, I guess. And then I thought, again, once from the mat, he'd be able to isolate an arm, probably get him with a Kimura, and that would be that. Kevin Holland, I don't know if he's been training with Nico Price a lot lately, but the power that he was able to generate on his way up, because it wasn't even just like, okay, if I throw an up kick off my back, I'm using my whole leg to basically just catapult it into your chin. Kevin Holland was kind of getting up, throws a crazy right hand, catches Jacare, and then puts him out shortly after. And that was one of the more violent finishes I think we could agree that I've seen in a while, at least. This kind of Jacare bent up against the cage and Kevin Holland just pieced him apart. Kevin Holland did everything perfect in this fight, though. He got his next fight lined up, and he beat one of the top contenders in his division. I can't say a single bad thing about Kevin Holland over this performance. He got a highlight for the reel. He got a great win, and he set up his next fight against maybe Chimaev, which is a fight that I'm sure before last night, no one would have been interested in seeing Kevin Holland fight Chimaev. The only thing they have in common is the fact that they're both pretty active. Kevin Holland just KO'd Jacare in the first round, and you have no idea how bad I want to see that fight now.
You know, so I'll give you the quote because you brought it up. So what he said was, stay down at, this is Holland speaking to Chimaev, stay down at 170, you can be a champion. If he comes up to 185, I'm going to bang that boy up, which is as good of a promo as you can cut. I want to talk about the Jacare stuff for a second in terms of Holland. Because if we're looking at this through the filter of him knocking out Jacare, as bad as Jacare has ever been knocked out, do you process this like, does the win over Jacare, and this is something that happens all the time, Matt, so I really want you to think about this in terms of how I'm presenting it. Did he beat Jacare and everything that comes with Jacare, or did he beat who Jacare is now and the level that he's on now? And how do you take, if you're the UFC, do you say, well, he beat Jacare, it's time for, now he's ready for the big time, or do you say, well, this is who Jacare is now, and if this guy's name was Ronaldo Allen, not Ronaldo Souza, this is what we would do with Kevin Holland. How do you process the version of Jacare that he beat?
That's a great question, and I think you'll enjoy my answer. So Anderson Silva, he is still fighting, I guess, if you want to say active, because he just fought that a little while ago. The last time we saw the Spider compete was against Michael Bisping. And then you look ahead to the guy who fought Jared Cannonier. That wasn't Anderson the Spider Silva. That was just Anderson Silva. For Jacare, I don't think we've seen Jacare since he fought Derek Brunson and knocked him out with that beautiful head kick. Yeah, he looked good against Chris Weidman. But again, it's an older Chris Weidman too. So you have to kind of look at where they both were at that stage in their career. I do think that matters. But again, for this fight, it's odd. I think you have to look at how he finished him, because Jacare, he's still phenomenal at jiu-jitsu. He's still a great wrestler. And for the most part, he could take a pretty good shot. So the fact that Kevin Holland was able to sort of neutralize all those things that Jacare is good at, I think we'd be looking at this fight a lot differently. If Kevin Holland went out there, defended the first takedown, started landing the jab on Jacare, and at the end of the first round, put him down with a right straight. I like the fact that Kevin Holland had to defend what Jacare is a specialist at. And he wasn't only able to defend it, he was then able to see sort of an offensive opportunity from the scrambles. I think if you're the UFC, you book Kevin Holland against whoever he wants to be matched up against. If it's Marvin Vettori, who had won last weekend, who kind of took his place in the main event, give him Marvin Vettori. If it's Hamzat Chimaev, give him Chimaev. Because the way he's able to go out there and finish people, and again, with Jacare, he didn't just finish him. He finished him on a highlight reel that's going to be circling like the UFC's kind of those promos forever. So I do like the question, but I think Kevin Holland, it comes down to how he beat Jacare, not who he beat in this fight.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, there's a lot to like about Holland. You know, the deeper you dig, there's a lot to like. First of all, he fights at 85. That I can think of, no issues really making the weight. He's 6'3", which is tall for a middleweight. He's at 81-inch reach, which is long for a middleweight. So, like, for me, and then you find out, okay, who's his coach? Oh, it's Travis Luter. So here's a guy who was, you know, was in there with Anderson. He's been around forever. He's a BJJ guy. So he's an old school guy. You know, you'd like to think most coaches are going to be old school guys, but there's a difference between being an old school guy and sort of asking your fighters to conform to you, and being an old school guy and conforming to your fighters, meaning you just are latching on to guys who might have some, you know, the ability to bring you back into the limelight again. I don't see that with Luter and Holland. So I'm with you. I think that he can handle it. Listen, the guy's already had five losses, so losing to Chimaev isn't the end of the road for him necessarily. If he was undefeated, you know, sometimes these guys that come in as highly touted prospects that are undefeated, they lose, and it's like their whole psyche is destroyed. You know, this guy knows what it's like to lose on a lower level and come back. So losing to Chimaev is not going to wreck him. So I'm with you. I think you put him in there, you see what he's got, and you know, you kind of go from there. I'm excited about him. I don't want to get too excited because we talk about these guys who we think might be the next. He's a little young in the game to be Jorge Masvidal, but you know, the next guy that's kind of, you know, Israel Adesanya is a better example. The next guy who's a young fighter, fights great, and then he's like this huge fan favorite who can, you know, carry a pay-per-view card on his own and all that. You see little seeds of that in certain fighters. You see that in Kevin Holland. But again, it's all a matter of how they're matched up. You know, the old saying in the NFL is, you know, you can be a great quarterback depending on where you go. I would love to sit down and have an interview with Kevin Holland. I may look into that. And the first question I would ask him is, I don't want to know what you want next. I want to know, if you were Mick Maynard, how would you handle your career? Because that's the question. How would you navigate getting you to the place where you think you can go? And it's not just you fighting every guy that comes, you know, down the line. All right, Craig. Almost called you Craig. All right, Matt.
Goodness.
I know, right? I had avoided that up until now. There was a time that Junior Dos Santos was the baddest man on the planet. Now he's just bad. He met Ciryl Gane on Saturday night in the Performance Center. And I have to be honest, it looked like easy work for Gane. He stayed away. He fought mostly from distance. He treated Junior like Chael Sonnen treated Wanderlei Silva, saying, "I can't let you get close." The result was a second round TKO for Gane. But I mean, listen, and I say this not in any sort of hyperbole, the guy barely broke a sweat. I mean, if you looked at him after the fight, he broke the kind of sweat, Matt, that you break when you're done working out. And you're like, the workout wasn't that tough, but I've stopped and now I'm sweating. So, I mean, is this just a case of out with the old and with the new? And is it now we're back to the Dana White 60 here? What'd you see in this fight? And can Junior still compete at the highest levels of heavyweight?
I agree with everything you just said. I think Junior shot. I think Ciryl Gane's the future, but I don't think it's just as cut and dry as that. I don't know about you, but even watching that fight, and maybe it's just me being such a big MMA fan and me growing up watching Junior Santos, there wasn't a moment in that fight where I didn't think he had the opportunity to knock out Ciryl Gane. And maybe that is just kind of my nostalgia looking back at all the great performances that he has had. But when he does throw that right hand, I was getting nervous. And Ciryl Gane went out there, and I really like what he does with his kicks. He immediately switches stances, shows you something different. Switches stances, gives you a look. Switches stances, gives you a look. Whether it be a lot of feints, if it's a strike, he's just always doing something that keeps his opponent thinking. And with Junior Santos, at this stage of his career, what does he do a lot of? Well, he takes a lot of punches he doesn't have to, and he puts his back against the cage. Against a guy like Ciryl Gane, you cannot get away with those things. And I think we sort of saw how the finish is going to go in the first round if you were watching Ciryl Gane closely. I thought Gane was going to end up finishing him with a head kick. I was zooming my friends watching the fights, and I was like, I don't know, that head kick's starting to get close. I could see him land it. The fact that he knocked out JDS with a jab and then an elbow was absurd to me. And it's really unfortunate for Ciryl Gane that they kept on saying, oh, was the elbow to the back of the head? Was the elbow to the back of the head? Let's just make something very clear right now. Did it hit him in the back of the head? Kind of. Does it matter? Not at all. JDS is moving away from the shot. Like, you can't get mad at someone from hitting you in the back of the head when you're basically putting the back of your head in the direction of their elbow. So it is unfortunate that the win was sort of clouded, if you will. And I also didn't like that Joe Rogan asked Ciryl Gane if he thought it was illegal when English isn't really Ciryl Gane's first language. Like, let him take a little bit of time to process it. Don't just be like, hey, do you think you hit him in the back of the head? Show him the replay that's not a great angle. And then kind of force Ciryl Gane to be like, I mean, maybe. Because then, like, then they're going to bring that up in the future of, well, Ciryl Gane even thinks he might have hit him in the head. How good is this win? This win is such a breakthrough win for Ciryl Gane. He's been stuck in that Ryan Hall category, if you will, of guys who don't have a name yet, but no one who has a number next to theirs wants to fight him. He's so dangerous. He's phenomenal on the ground. If last night was the first time you've watched Ciryl Gane fight, his ground game is phenomenal. He goes for heel hooks, arm bars, chokes. He can do it no matter where the fight goes. And the fact that he was able to KO JDS again with a jab, which really set the whole thing up, but he hurts him with a jab, finishes him on the feet. I can't say enough good things about Ciryl Gane. And Giro Santos, I don't think I'm breaking any news. He's on Dana White's list for 60. Like, the second that fight was over, Dana White probably just wrote his name on a whiteboard. He was like, all right, we don't really care where he goes. It's unfortunate to say, I love Giro Santos, but losing four fights by TKO in a row, it really is. There's only one place you're going to, and that's Bellator.
Yeah, the one of the things that Gane does that I like, and you see a couple of fighters do this, and mostly it's guys that are like sort of known for switching stances. But the thing that he does is he'll use one technique to allow him to switch stances into another technique. So he'll throw one leg and then he'll plant that foot. And then now he's southpaw, or now he's orthodox, or he'll miss a technique and he'll switch stances. And it's just very fluid. And I'm with you on where it's probably next for Dos Santos. It's one of these weird things. Here's the thing. Let me just put the audience and Joe Rogan and everybody at ease and simply say, never ask a victorious fighter if the way that he won was illegal. It's not fair to the fighter. It's not his decision. There's nothing you're going to do except muddy the fight, and the fight is over. There's nothing he can do. You can ask a fighter who lost if he felt he was hit in the back of the head. You can add this whole thing of like, did you tap? Were you did? Come on. It's a waste of time. You should never expect to get an honest answer from it. And it's a stupid question to ask. I'm with you. So we kind of both have, you know, I actually think Junior Dos Santos in Bellator would be a lot of fun. I mean, I can see him. There are certain guys you just can't see in a Bellator cage. I can see Junior in that cage. There's something about it. But, he had a great run. Let me ask you a opinion question here, which is, would you rather see a fighter diminish their legacy where they establish their legacy, or would you rather just see them move on to something else and either diminish it or create a new one? Like, meaning, is it better to watch Junior Dos Santos fight like shit in the UFC or maybe be okay in Bellator?
I think the question comes down to, does he really want to compete anymore? Because if he does want to compete, I just don't think it's viable for him to be in the UFC at this point in his career. And I never thought I'd be saying that. Like, Junior Santos, there's a real possibility. He gets cut from the UFC before Andrei Arlovsky does. And Andrei Arlovsky was on, what, a 6-fight losing streak at one point. I understand the economy is a little bit different, and this year's been a little rocky, but still, it's just wild to see JDS in this stage of his career. He was never a guy who I looked at and I thought, wow, like, they're going to be a former champ who's going to be outside the top 15. I'm going to have to get used to seeing them without a number next to their name. Like, Robbie Lawler's in a bit of a similar situation. The difference is Robbie Lawler can still take damage and he can still sort of return. It just comes down to, oh, are his reactions what they used to be? And is it the power that he used to? With JDS, he just can't really accept damage at this point. And it's hard to see because any clean shot that hits him, not that he gets dropped by it, but he does seem to get hurt by even the slightest tap. And again, he's fighting guys like Ciryl Gane, Yarsenio Rosenstrike, Francis and Curtis Blades. Like, getting knocked out by them isn't always to say that you don't belong in the UFC, but the fact that it's just been one after the other, after the other, after the other, and that you can tell that the strikes are less damaging. Like, the Curtis Blades shot that he got hit with, where he faced the takedown, gets hit with the right straight. I'm sure that punch hurt. But that would not have hurt the Junior Santos who's going 5 hard rounds with Cain Velasquez. The jab that Ciryl Gane hit him with was not going to put out the JDS who, you know, knocked out Cain in their first fight or knocked out the Fabrice Silverdoom. We're not even seeing this same fighter anymore. So I'd almost rather him, if he does want to keep on competing, go to Bellator. And I'm not one of these guys who thinks that, okay, when your UFC run is over, go to Bellator. But for JDS, they do have a decent heavyweight division full of at least big names that we can at least get excited seeing JDS fight them. Like, I know I'd be really excited to see him fight Fedor. Maybe we get it, maybe we never do, but that's at least one possible matchup looking towards the future that I still get excited over.
You know, when we talk about Legends League, and Craig and I talked about Legends League on Early Stoppage, I mean, this is I'll say the poster child for it, but if Fedor is going to fight somebody, this is the guy, right? Oh, yeah. Somebody like this. This is, we're a former heavyweight champion, a fight we never got to get. And then, you know, I think JDS, if we could coin a term, JDS has moved into that part of his career where he's about poster fights. He's about a fight that looks good on a poster. And if he can find those people in Bellator, more power to him. And I think he can. I think he has at least three good checks he can cash in Bellator that, you know, instead of watching him look like this in the UFC. And when you start talking about him early on, this is my problem. When you're a former champ and you've been relegated to it being said, like you said earlier, like I kind of felt like he could still land that right hand. Well, that's the definition of a puncher's chance. And when you're a former champion and we've relegated you to a puncher's chance, it's probably time to move on and do something else. Whether it's, you know, obviously he's not going to, in other weight classes, you might change divisions. Obviously, he's not going to go to 205. But, like, you know, change divisions, change promotions, change gyms. It's time for something new when you're a former champion and we're saying you got a puncher's chance. All right, Matt, let's move on to the prelims. I watched some, Matt. Not early, but I watched some.
Wow.
I watched some ones that I liked. All right, let's start with Cub Swanson and Daniel Pineda. It was Cub Swanson defeating Pineda by knockout in the second round, 152. It was interesting that Pineda took this fight because the talk coming in was that he was on, you know, he was like the flavor of the month based on his last performance. And he goes, there with a guy like Cub Swanson, who's cut from that Masvidal, Cerrone kind of guy that, like, was good enough at one time that he could still give you a hell of a night when he's on. And he was on, and he knocked Pineda out. And you know what's weird? You know, they always say, give these guys a chance to fight. No early stoppages. I get that. But it felt like in the first round, we knew that Pineda was in trouble. And he never – because I felt like Cub didn't adequately swarm in that first round. He had Pineda hurt and kind of laid back a little bit. But then Pineda still seemed like he was a little bit on in la-la land in the second. And then ultimately Cub closed the show. What do you think about this one?
So, I mean – I'm not happy I'm about to admit this on camera. My favorite boxer ever is Deontay Wilder. I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for that. I know his technique's not great or anything. But Daniel Pineda walking around in that second round kind of reminded me of Wilder after he did get his eardrum busted or whatever excuse he wants to go with. It just, he never really seemed back into the fight after that original knockdown. And I've really harped on Cub Swanson a lot. The fact that he's older than LeBron James coming back off an ACL tear, it really worried me. And I always compare everything to basketball because it is always wild to me that we can call some guy an MMA a prospect at 31. And then you look at like Kevin Durant, and he's currently 31 and already accomplished so much. But for Daniel Pineda, I thought he was going to run away with this fight. We've seen Cub Swanson struggle with guys who are really good on the ground, who have good ground and pound, who are good at getting from position to position. Because with Cub Swanson, everyone always talks about, he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. There's levels to being a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and I didn't think Cub Swanson was on the same level as Daniel Pineda, especially after seeing what Daniel Pineda did to Herbert Burns, brother of Gilbert, because he got into that crucifix and just elbowed and elbowed and elbowed poor Herbert. And I was like, okay, if you can do that to Herbert Burns on the ground, I can only imagine what you can get away with Cub Swanson on the ground. But Cub Swanson fought one of those y'all must have forgot kind of fights. He defended the takedowns when he needed to. His hands looked crisp. And I think Cub really needed a win like this. I'm not breaking any news. And he did sort of talk about this after the fight where when he had heard Dana White talk about, oh, we're going to have some cuts near the end of the year. Cub knew if he didn't win this fight, his name was probably going to be on that list. Couldn't be happier for him getting this win because Cub Swanson, a card always just feels like it's going to be a little more exciting when his name's on there. He's in that, you know, the Matt Brown, the Carlos Condit, those guys who, yes, they're past their prime and you might not always see them win. But every time they step in that cage, they're going to give you at least a fun performance or a memorable performance. And the fact that Cub Swanson hopefully saves his job with this fight, I'm really happy about it. For Daniel Pineda, I'm going to give Craig a little bit of rub on this. Daniel Pineda was Craig's favorite on this card. He was really confident he was going to be able to get it done. And I'm not going to lie, I agreed with him. I thought Pineda was going to be able to absolutely walk through Cub Swanson. Cub Swanson was not playing around last night, though. Really great performance for him. And it's a performance that says, okay, I can see Cub Swanson fight some up-and-comers, fight some of those guys who are going to make noise at 145, and he's a great litmus test to just throw them in there with.
Yeah, Swanson was moving into that territory where there's a few guys who have like connections to people that work for the UFC, and it seems like they stay around a little bit longer than they should. Like, I think Josh Berkman was married to Ariane Celeste. Joseph Benavidez has Megan O'Leary, and now Coach Swanson is married to Kenda Perez, who 100 years ago was affiliated with the UFC. And he was starting to be like, why are they keeping this guy around? Is it like because Dana, you know, Dana's buddies with Kenda Perez or what? So that's where I think that last night was a big night for Cub Swanson, in the sense that this is going to – if he wasn't prepared to have the retirement talk of what he's going to do next, this fight gives him the time to figure out what's next and to say, okay, I had a good performance. They'll probably keep me around for a couple more fights. They probably have like a path they can put me on now. But now I got to figure out what's next. And I'm going to go ahead and coin a phrase. I don't know that I'm the first person to say this. I'll say this. I'd never heard it before I thought of it. So henceforth, I think that final shot that Cub put on Pineda that was completely academic, we just call that a hendo. It's just a hendo, because that's basically what it was. It's what hendo did to Bisping. All right, let's move on. We talked way longer than that fight than we should have, because Rafael Fiziev defeated Renato Moicano by knockout round number one. 405 of it. I got a lot to say, but I'm going to let you run with it. What'd you see here?
Okay, so then I can discredit myself a little bit. For as confident as Craig was about Pineda on the last fight that we just went over, I was that confident about Renato Moicano getting this win. I am so high on Renato Moicano. I guess they're speaking past tense. I was so high on Renato Moicano. I thought, you look at what he did at 145. It really went unnoticed. I think the wins over Calvin Kattar and Jeremy Stephens are two wins that, up a weight class, they do mean something, because those are two really tough, two really gritty guys. And yes, Fiziev is this phenomenal striker, but I thought Moicano was going to go in there. I thought he was going to be able to land some leg kicks, maybe eventually get a trip takedown. And once it's on the ground, I didn't even think this fight would be close. The fact that Renato Moicano went out there like he was Charles Oliveira with that high stance, bringing the front leg up against one of the better Muay Thai fighters in the UFC, it was just odd. And the hand speed of Fiziev is, I don't want to say second to none, because I'm sure someone can correct me, but his striking really is phenomenal. I don't know where to put his ceiling, because we do kind of have to see what the rest of his MMA game looks like. But if you can go out there and knock out someone like Renato Moicano in the first round, it is extremely impressive. And I am excited to see where Fiziev goes in the future, because you beat Mark Cicchese. Okay, Mark Cicchese, he's an exciting guy. He's someone who you get excited for his fights, but he's not an elite fighter by any means. Renato Moicano, down a weight class, if you want to use the word elite, you might get a little bit of pushback, but he was a very high level featherweight. And for Fiziev to just go out there and KO him without much trouble in the first round is super impressive. I love the combos that he kept on landing too. He's not afraid to go body and to the head, really mixes it up on guys. I think Fiziev can go in there and can beat some of the top guys in the division. He did call out a name that I brought up earlier. He had sent out a tweet and he said, "Hey, Ally Aquinta, if you want to fight me on the same card that Aljamain Sterling fights Piotr Jan, we can do a Tiger Muay Thai versus Long Island card." I think that's a great call-out. I think that's a great matchup. And I think it's a fight that a lot of people get excited for looking towards the future. I'm curious what your thoughts on this one were.
So, you know, I talked to Shaquille Majuri recently for Revisionist MMA, and that's going to be coming out soon. You guys can check it out. And the conversation we had is that, and I might have brought this up last podcast, but the conversation we had was, why do we think that it's so much more nuanced on the ground, and that, you know, the ground is chess and the stand-up is checkers? And I said to the statement that I said to him was, is it not more impressive if you're the world's greatest checker player, because everybody plays checkers, than if you're the world's greatest chess player, if only a certain percentage of people play chess? And I think that's what we're seeing in Fiziev. Like, we know what we see because you're watching a guy get busted up, as opposed to we see a bunch of stuff happen on the ground and the next thing you know, some guy's tapping to the layman. But I think that with Fiziev, it's like, you know, those combos, man, they just don't come out of nowhere. And I think that Moicano made the mistake. And I don't want to give Fiziev as much credit as to say that he let Moicano think that he was doing well. But, you know, maybe he wasn't expecting Moicano to stand with him. He didn't think he would do that well, so Moicano found some early success. And the mistake that he made was thinking that success was a recipe for victory, when in reality, he was sitting in front of a bomb and the clock was winding down. And instead of trying to defuse it, he was figuring out a way to make the clock go faster. And it was like, as I'm watching this fight, I was like, well, you know, I should have known this was going to happen. And I think that some of these guys, like Fazeev, like even Connor, like Adesanya, we feel like Chuck Liddell 100 years ago, we feel like, oh, if he finds his shot, then it'll happen. And then we equate that to what we talked about with Junior, which is a puncher's chance. Like, oh, if he finds his shot or if he hits his shot. What we're finding out as we get older and as the game evolves is that they're not finding their shot so much as they're setting a mousetrap and leaving a big-ass piece of cheese in it, and you're walking into it, and when they grab the cheese, the trap shuts on you. And I think that Moicano he thought he had the cheese and Fazeev was the trap. And I think that's what these guys have. And I think they probably had it much longer than people like me have said they had it. But I think it's time to start giving the stand-up game its props, because in boxing, we're prepared to give it the props because that's all that we have. You know, we watch, you know, if you're a casual, you watch Conor and Mayweather fight and you go, oh, Conor did well. And if you're not a casual, you go, Floyd Mayweather just carried this guy for 10 rounds so he could have a rematch with him if he wanted to. And I think that's, you know, I think we're seeing that with a lot of these guys. The thing I do like about Fazeev moving forward is he's only 27. And more importantly, he's only been fighting for 5 years. So he's not this guy that tried MMA super young. I think that he's coming into his own when he's not like, I think he wanted to be a coach. He probably wanted to do Muay Thai. That's the life that he wants to live. But he's realizing that a lot of the skills that he has, he can make better use of in this environment. You know, he's going to make more money in the UFC than he would make fighting Muay Thai fights and being a coach. So I think that he's understanding it, and he's matured enough in his career to now make that move. And the fact that he's only lost once over 5 years and over whatever it is, 10 fights, I like that. I mean, I'm not saying he can be a champion, but he checks a lot of the boxes. Like, he's where he should be, if that makes sense. So I'm bullish on the guy.
I agree 100%. It comes down, for me at least, to what the heck do you do with Moicano next? Like, this is a guy who, he's main evented a show before. He's fought Jose Aldo. He's had quite a few opportunities in the UFC at the weight class that a lot of people thought he was going to succeed at. And now we see him up at 155. Okay, so you beat Demir Hadzovic. It's a good win, but it's not one that's going to blow your hair back by any means. And then you get TKO'd again for the third time in your last four fights against Rafael Fazeev. So I don't really know what they do with Moicano going forward. I don't want him to be on that list of 60, though. I do think he's a talented guy. He is still fairly young in his career, could get some good wins. But for Fazeev, I'm extremely excited for the future. I'm ready to see him get in with some of those, we'll call them those bubble 15ers. Maybe they don't have a number next to their name, but they're that one win away. I'd love to see an Alexander Hernandez fight. I know he's really bounced back lately and done really well. So for Fazeev, the sky is the limit. And for Moicano, so many question marks about his future. I'm really concerned about what the UFC does with him, and really even if they keep him.
Yeah, Moicano's an interesting guy because Dana said this in the past. So if you start to string together, and listen, Dana is like his buddy Trump, which is he has situational ethics and he's prepared to say whatever he needs to say in the moment. So you can't necessarily take a history of Dana White quotes and put together any sort of logic or predict the future based on them. But I will say this. He said in the past that if a guy's not going for a title, or if a guy's not willing, is not on the title path, we got no use for him. So the question becomes, I think with Dana and this 60 is a couple of things. Who am I paying, and how much am I paying them? And does he, it's almost like Moneyball in a way. Dana's going to look at two fighters and say, okay, who's Moicano's equivalent in this division? And am I paying him less? And does he have a better upside moving forward? Is he younger? Does he have more quality wins? Is there a better chance he could develop into a champion? That's smart business, and I'll give him that. And that may be where he goes. But I guess the question becomes, and the other thing that I would imagine they'll ask is, if he leaves, how much of a loss is it? Is Sonato Moicano going to go to PFL and all of a sudden be a star? Is he going to Bellator and all of a sudden be a star? Is it better to have the guys with star power or potential to hang around? So I think that's what we'll see. All right, next up. Very interested in this fight. Lot to say. Gavin Tucker defeated Billy Quarantillo via decision, 30-27s all over the board. But that doesn't really tell the story, does it, Matt? This is a fight where Gavin Tucker looked really good. And here's the thing that I'm starting to see with a guy like Quarantillo. And and you can give me your thoughts on this. I don't want to be reductive and call him Clay Guida, but I will say this. He's a guy that walks into the cage, says, I have a pace that not a lot of guys can match. So that will be the thing that rules the day in my fight. And I can afford to not have the greatest technique because of my pace until he runs into a guy like Gavin Tucker, who's almost his equal from a cardio standpoint in terms of I can go the three rounds. I can maintain who I need to be for three rounds. I may not be able to exactly match your pace, but I can hang. And I'm much better technically. And I felt like Quarantillo fought out here on the fringes. My arms are outstretched, if you will. And Gavin Tucker fought right down Main Street. You know, the best way I can put it is Tucker was in the median and Quarantillo was on the sidewalk. And that's how the fight took place. And, you know, I thought early on that Tucker didn't have it, and he just snatched that fight away from him. I said a lot there. What do you have to say about this one?
So, okay, Gavin Tucker is a really interesting case, and try not to be biased, but he is from our side of Canada, from Newfoundland, trains in Nova Scotia. So he's a stone's throw away, really. And this was a hard fight, and it was a fight that going into it, I picked Billy Q. I thought he was going to be able to get it done. But you did kind of tell, you could tell where the fight was going to go by the first round on. Gavin Tucker was just landing too many clean shots. And you can say, well, yeah, Quarantillo has the cardio. You might have the cardio advantage, but when you're eating that many clean shots, and I do like what Gavin Tucker does. He reminds me a little bit of Brandon Moreno, and I'm only going to use it for this aspect. He kind of has these pre-downloaded combos in his head that he knows he's going to throw. With Moreno, it's always that 1-2 left high kick, 1-2 left high kick. Like, if the 1-2 is coming, you know the left high kick is. For Gavin Tucker, it's that 1-2 steps around. He throws that really nice right straight. He can do it with the left too. We're seeing the Gavin Tucker that we thought we were going to see after his first UFC performance against Sam Cecilia. That's going back a ways, but if you remember that performance at all, he was clowning on him the whole time. He fought like he was Cody Garbrandt. He would move out of the way of Sam Cecilia, and then he'd point at the ground and like make him come back to him. He just clowned on him the whole entire performance. And he became, this is wild to think of, but he became a Joe Rogan favorite, where Joe Rogan's like, wow, that kid's really good at all. Look at the upside to him. And then, of course, his next fight against Rick Glenn, who will be seeing next weekend compete. Rick Glenn beat him almost as bad as I've ever seen an MMA fighter get beat. And I do think that clouded my judgment for the negative when I look at Gavin Tucker, because his last three wins, so he beat Sungwoo Choi. It's a good win, but it's not the highest level of competition. He beats Justin James, a really heavy-handed guy, a good wrestler. But those two wins didn't really prove that much to me. He got dropped in the James fight. He did well on the mat. Beating Billy Quarantillo the way that he did, where he was able to out-wrestle him, he out-grappled him, he out-struck him, and really, he had better cardio than him by the end of the fight, just because he was able to land some clean shots, get the takedown, and mix things up. That really, if Gavin Tucker can be matched up the proper way, because when you look at him, he is 34, and he's in that category, and there's quite a few fighters like this, where you look at their record at 13-1, and you're like, oh, what are they, like 26? And then you go look at their age, and they're 34 years old. He has a lot that he needs to be able to accomplish within the next, we'll say, 2 years at featherweight. And it's just really, really hard to see where the future for Gavin Tucker is. I love this win over Billy Quarantillo. I think it's one of the better wins, well, by far the best win he has in the UFC. But it's really hard for me to gauge where Gavin Tucker goes from here. I'm still kind of stuck in this same position. I know he can really switch things up. He's dynamic. He's well-rounded. But I have yet to see him really push one of the highest level guys that we see. And for that reason alone, again, I think Gavin Tucker has a really bright future. I like a lot what I'm seeing from him. I think he does have some of those it factors when you look at him outside of the cage. But his age really does worry me moving forward.
Yeah, well, here's where he ends up. He ends up being a hell of a coach, because they said in the commentary that he's like one of these guys that watch his tape. So everything that you saw from Gavin Tucker last night tells you that at some point he's going to be a good coach. I don't know that he had, you know, it troubles me that, okay, so it's 2020. So he started his career in 2011, so 9 years ago. So 34 minus 9, what do we got, 25. So he started 25, which isn't super late, but it's like you said, we had a guy we just talked about in Fazeev that's 9-1 at 27. This guy's 13-1 at 34. It's just not enough activity for me. So, but, you know, listen, you got to fall in love with the analytics. What I love about what he did last night was he took everything that Billy Quarantillo was giving him and he turned it into actionable data that I can look at. So I'm looking at 106 strikes. I'm looking at 60% accuracy, and I'm looking at 7 of 13 takedowns. I mean, that's everything that you would want from the guy. I mean, he took all of Quarantino's energy and put it into offense of his own. He's like, if this is the pace you want to go at, fine. I can hit you 106 times. I can try to take you down third. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot to get done in three rounds.
It is.
So,
I mean, listen, I was impressed. But again, my whole thing with Gavin Tucker is I was so high on him after his first UFC fight against Sam Cecilia. And that Rick Glenn fight completely ruined his hype for me. So maybe nothing will ever be enough. Maybe that is the problem. And maybe no matter what happens in Gavin Tucker's career, I won't ever be impressed. But I like what we're seeing. Again, it just always comes down to the age. And at 145, okay, who do we match him up next with who gets him into that top 15? Maybe like a Mirsad Bektic, a guy who's been on a bit of a bad streak lately, but a guy who was in the top 15. Maybe you do Darren Elkins. Like, it's not an easy weight class. And the fact that he is 34 just makes me nervous going forward. But I do agree with you, this was an impressive performance.
Well, what I mean is, if we're going to match him up, I think we match him up with somebody who's similar to him in the sense that they're clean. Because these last two wins, although they're impressive, they're against guys who are sort of unrefined. You know, Billy Q is not a guy that you think of when you think of technique. Neither is really Justin James. They're guys that can collect performance of the night bonuses because they're high energy. They swing for the bleachers, and that's who they are. I don't know that they're as technical as Tucker is. So basically, both of those guys ran into a guy who was really squared away, and they got sorted out by him. So I want to see a fellow guy. I think Bektic's just a great call. I think that would be an interesting fight to really see where Tucker is, because he's not just going to be able to go down Main Street with a guy who's kind of not flailing, but, you know, who fights on the outside in terms of, you know, he throws looping shots. So that's what makes Tucker moving forward interesting for me. All right, let's hit these last two. Tish Torres defeated Sam Hughes via TKO by Dr. Stoppage. Round one, 5 minutes of. What you see here?
It was a really one-sided fight, and Sam Hughes didn't really belong in there with Tisha Torres. Craig and I went over this. Tisha Torres only really loses to the upper echelon in the division. Other than the Marina Rodriguez loss, you look through it. She loses to Jessica Andrade. No shame in that whatsoever. Yuana Yan Jacek. No shame in that. Weili Zhang. No shame in that. And then Marina Rodriguez, and of course, her last two wins being Sam Hughes, Brianna Van Buren. I was impressed by Torres. I did like her regression. I think she showed the things that you need to show when you do fight. Again, when you do fight a fighter who doesn't belong to be in there with you, because Hughes was such a big underdog, Tisha Torres had to prove that, yes, I am still elite in this division. And when I say elite, I just mean people who can at least fight those top five guys, and women, I guess, in this case. But Torres is going to give anyone a hard fight. And the fact that the UFC threw in someone on their debut on short notice, we kind of knew what we were going to get. It's nice that Torres got a finish, being only the second out of her 12 wins. But again, I don't really think we learned that much from either fighter in this one.
Yeah, Torres to me is the kind of person that, you know, if you need a short notice, like a big fight falls out, you can put her in there. I mean, obviously, we really would have seen where she was at. She got in there with Angela Hill. That's the fight we wanted. That's the fight we should have got.
Yeah.
So she did what she was supposed to do. You put her in there, even on short notice, against someone who's a massive underdog. She should go in there and clean her out, and that's what she did. All right, Matt, let's finish up with Chase Hooper defeating Peter Barrett by submission via heel hook. Round three, 302 of it. What you see here?
Beautiful submission. Again, this was one of those fights where it's not a gimme that the UFC's given you, but let's be honest. If you could ask Dana White before this fight happened, who would you like to win? He would have said Chase Hooper, of course. And so they give him a guy who doesn't have great takedown defense, who's been submitted before in his career. And again, Craig brought up a great point on our prediction show. Chase Hooper is going to be fighting men for the next little bit. And he himself is not one of them. He's only 21 years old. It's still wild to me that I'm older than some fighters in the UFC at this point, being only 22. But he was fighting Peter Barrett, who's a good striker. He's going to offer you a few different looks. But at the end of the day, Chase Hooper should have won this fight. I love the way that he won it. Again, we don't really see a lot of heel hooks in the UFC. But I thought it was a good performance. I thought it was one of those back on the horse type performances for Chase Hooper. But again, Chase Hooper's in that weird position where I think he's way too green to be in the UFC still. I'm going to stand by that. He's like Mickey Gall to me, where I think they signed him too early. And when you look at their ceiling, let's say Chase Hooper was able to do the regional route and maybe get signed by an LFA, work his way up, have a couple losses, and then come into the UFC as a more finalized product. I'd be a lot more excited. But for Chase Hooper at 145, there's no easy fights. And they went Daniel Kamer. David's quite a bit better. They went Alex Caceres, who's beaten Sergio Pettis. He fought Uriah Faber. He's fought Yair Rodriguez. So he's quite a bit higher. And now you go Peter Barrett. So all I know is that Chase Hooper is better than Peter Barrett and worse than Alex Caceres. That is a massive gap right now. And I don't really know what the UFC's plan is to work Chase Hooper up the rankings in the future.
I think they're a little bit trying to hide him. I think that he had gotten too high of a profile. And then, you know, when he fought Caceres, there was like this weird, like, here's this 20-year-old kid who's now fighting a high-profile fight. And, you know, because Caceres hasn't fought a lot of big fights. He's fought enough guys with names, and he's a wild guy. Like, you know Alex Caceres when you see him. Oh, and yeah. I think that it's hard to, you know, Chase started to move up the card a little bit. I think this was an opportunity to, like, let's put him on the early prelims. Let's put him against a guy nobody knows. Let's let him evolve. And we've been shouting about this guy. Maybe it's time to whisper and give him a little bit of time to just develop. And we don't want to do him to do that on the regionals. We want to keep him in our this is, to me, the poster child for, like, you tell the kid. Here's the weird part about the UFC PI. It's really smart to have a performance center in Las Vegas. It's really smart to incentivize fighters to train and, you know, and go to the performance center. Unfortunately, it's in Las Vegas. So for them to train at the performance center and live there, they have to live in Vegas, which presents its own set of problems. So I think that it's, you know, it's one of those things where they might be well served. You know, if everybody's moving to Texas or everybody's moving wherever, put a performance center someplace where it's not, you know, honestly, if you can't figure out what to do with some of these fighters, you know, I almost feel like these UFC gyms, they let a couple of fighters open them and made a big deal about them. I almost feel like they should have let fighters, you know, make them be performance centers and say, okay, we're going to do this regionally and there's going to be a UFC gym or slash performance center on the East Coast, one in the Midwest, one in the upper, you know, upper Midwest, you know, one in the Southwest kind of thing. So, I think he fits into that mold where they'd like to keep him in their program, but not necessarily. You know what? Here's the best way to put it. Chase Hooper's a G League guy. There's your NBA comparison. Yeah. He's a guy that you need to let go develop and not really put him in the fire quite yet. All right, Matt, let's move on to the wrap. Let's talk some housekeeping notes. The fights of the night, or the fight of the night, was Davison Figueiredo and Brandon Moreno. Performances of the night, Kevin Holland and Rafael Fiziev. Any problems there?
Not really. I kind of expected Cub Swanson to get it over Fiziev, just personally. I really like that knockout. I love those, like, the way that he hit him with the right hand over the shoulder after he was already hurt from the uppercut. Just kind of a piece of beauty. I thought that was a really nice performance by Cub Swanson. I thought they would reward him for getting his first knockout in 7 years, but other than that, I really can't complain with any of the performance bonuses.
All right, let's move on to the victory lap. All right, we're going to keep this nice and clean. I need you to give me in the victory lap where you were right. And then we'll move on to where you were wrong. All right, tell me where you felt like you saw it coming and you nailed it.
Okay, this could be one of the shortest victory laps ever, and I can openly say that. So Ciryl Gane kind of figured he was going to beat JDS by horrible stoppage. Got that one right. I was wrong about the vast majority of these. Tisha Torres, I'd say Sam Hughes probably didn't belong in there with her. But yeah, no, your next segment's going to be a lot better than this one.
So let's talk where you went wrong. And here's the thing. When we talk about this, it's not to just say, hey, I was great here and here's where I sucked. I want to talk in this second segment about what you just didn't see coming. And what were the things in where you were wrong you just didn't see coming from certain fighters?
So I didn't see Kevin Holland knocking out Jacare off of his back during a scramble. I can openly admit that. I don't think many people did, but it's not really how I predicted that fight. That fight didn't go at all how I thought it would. Again, I said Jacare was probably going to get the takedown, but I thought the second it hit the mat, Jacare was going to have a lot more success because of Kevin Holland. We saw the Brendan Allen fight. He hurt him on the feet. He had him rocked. But the second Brendan Allen was able to get it to the ground, he's a really physical grappler, and I would put Jacare in that category as well. He was just able to really overpower Kevin Holland and work his way to the back. I thought Jacare would be able to do something very similar throughout that fight. Wrong on that.
Real quick, one thing I want to say about this before you move on, and I meant to mention this earlier when I talked about Holland's unique build. One of the things that some of these guys benefit from, some of these fighters like John Jones or whatever, you know, back in the day, the thing that made Tito Ortiz special, and he's not necessarily built in a special way, but he figured out a way to do ground and pound from the guard. And at the time, he would take somebody down. If he ended up in their guard, it wasn't the end of the story for him. And if he couldn't pass, he could still strike from the guard. John Jones could strike from the guard. Kevin Holland, there's not a lot of guys who can even physically hit that shot that he hit on Jacare. So why that makes him an interesting fighter moving forward is that traditionally, even in training, there are times when fighters feel safe like, you know, it's protect yourself at all times, but there's times, there's positions where you feel like I'm in no real trouble here. And I can guarantee you Jacare felt like I'm not in trouble here. I might lose my position, but I'm not in trouble. And he found out very quickly that he was. And I think that that needs to be taken into consideration with a guy like Holland moving forward.
No, I agree 100%. Also, is this the second week in a row that we had two fighters going from smiling to knocked out in about 5 seconds? Because Jacare was getting a kick out of what Kevin Holland was saying off his back. He was kind of laughing along with it. And the next thing you know, it's Kevin Holland. Man, I had a dream about this. And you're asleep. So
now you're really going to have a dream about it.
I might, honestly. Listen, any of these people could easily knock me out.
Once Holland knocked out Jacare, he said, I had a dream about this. And now Jacare is going to have a dream about this because I'm putting him out.
It was just, that's wild to me. And I love the fact that Kevin Holland can promote himself. The Cub Swanson performance really did impress me because Cub Swanson, I'm going to put him in a certain Jean Volante category. And trust me, that sounds extremely disrespectful, but I'm going to work my way back from here. Right before Jean Volante's last fight at heavyweight, they had said, oh, he's a knockout artist. But you look at his record and the last KO he had had was in 2016 against Saverbeck Safarov. Cub Swanson is always pinned as this, oh, he's a knockout artist, oh, he's a knockout artist. The last knockout he had was in 2013 against Dennis Seaver. He hasn't knocked out anyone since then. So I really discredited the power that he still kept in his hands. I thought he was more of a volume guy at this stage in his career. And even playing that game, I didn't think he was going to have much success. So I'm really impressed by what Cub Swanson was able to do. And the fact that he did all of this coming off an ACL surgery at the age that he is, I could not have been more wrong about that fight.
You know, it's interesting. That's one of those like backhanded compliments. Like when someone calls you like a jack of all trades and a master of none, telling somebody that they're a knockout artist when they haven't had a knockout in a while is saying the only way you could win this fight is by knockout. You haven't had it in a while. So here's us telling you that we don't feel too great about it.
Yeah. And again, really good job by Cub Swanson. I think that was the first time that we've seen Cub Swanson, he just looked comfortable in that fight. And I don't know if it was one of those cases where he knew his back was up against the wall with the cuts coming up and whatnot, but when he needed to have a performance like he did last night, he was able to show it. So really good job on his part. And then the last fight that I got wrong, but I am going to give myself a bit of a pat on the back on this, Charles Oliveira, Tony Ferguson. I thought Tony Ferguson, his striking is better than Charles Oliveira's. Charles Oliveira is the more technical striker out of these two. But when you put it into practice and what they've done in MMA, Tony Ferguson is the much superior striker. I did say going into this fight that this might be the first time Ferguson's fought someone who is a better grappler when it comes to jiu-jitsu than himself. I didn't think Charles Oliveira was going to have that much success once the fight hit the mat. So if he did hit him with that first round armbar, and I really like what you had brought up too. We talk about Charles Oliveira very differently than if we see Charles Oliveira defeats Tony Ferguson by armbar 4 minutes, 59 seconds in the first round, than if we see Charles Oliveira beat Tony Ferguson by unanimous decision. And it's odd to me how we talk about like the, oh, well, Cody Garbrandt dropped TJ Dillashaw and there was only 10 seconds left. Yes, TJ came back and won that fight, but with Charles Oliveira, his career probably changes more based on whether or not he gets that submission in the first round or not. Like, that's the type of widespread appeal that would cause. If you're able to submit Tony Ferguson, that's not only just attached to your record. People are going to be talking about that for weeks, for months to come. And the more people who say your name, the more high-profile fights you're going to get. So although Oliveira won, and I was extremely impressed by what he did, if he was able to get that submission in the first round, I think the whole narrative about Charles Oliveira would be very different today.
Yeah, and in reality, he got it. He just ran into a guy that was like, nope.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, it's when you run into somebody that stubborn, you know, again, not to get too political on here, but it's like saying, you know, if you're Joe Biden, you win the presidency and someone just refuses to accept it. It's like, well, I mean, I still kind of, I submitted Tony Ferguson. He just refused to acknowledge the fact that I was shredding his arm. That's on him. All right. All right, Matt, let's talk about what's going to stick with you from this card. Give me some of your takeaways for the night. Maybe some places where, like, your mind's changed and you're like, I didn't think this was not my reality before this card, but it's my reality now.
I hope Joe Rogan never does a UFC pay-per-view again. Boom. I'm sorry. He wasn't good on the last card, but I'm firmly in this company where I'm like, okay, just give him one more chance. Because when Rogan is on, I do have more fun watching the card. I do think he does offer a little bit to the broadcast, but the last two pay-per-views have just kind of hammered it home. They've been the final nails in the coffin for me, where it's just, okay, I've seen Joe Rogan commentate one Tony Ferguson fight. I know how he's going to do every Tony Ferguson fight for the rest of his life now. When Tony Ferguson gets taken down, Joe Rogan's immediately going to say, well, he's dangerous in his guard. There's a difference between being dangerous with your guard against, I don't know, a Cowboy Cerrone or an Anthony Pettis, and Charles Oliveira, who's one of the best grapplers in the world. Like, there's some of those little key points that I understand they are valuable, but with context, am I really worried about Tony Ferguson's guard when he's fighting Charles Oliveira? Not at all. They're on the ground and Oliveira is probably going to beat him. So there were so many little Joe Roganisms, like the Brandon Moreno broken arm in that fifth round. Like, oh, he hurt himself. Oh, he hurt himself. And then they asked Brandon Moreno. He's like, well, yeah, my shoulder hurts. But that was more because of what Figueiredo did. It just, I'm starting to get kind of tired of those really hard-hitting narratives that Joe Rogan likes to push, that, and then the fight's over and they never really mattered in the first place. So honestly, if I'm giving an L to anyone on this card, I'm probably giving it to Joe Rogan.
Oh, well, let's talk about who you're going to give the W to then. Who won the night? Who do you think the guy is?
Who won the night? Kevin Holland won the night. I think we both agree on this. The fact that he went out there, he got a knockout I've never seen before, cut a promo I didn't think he was capable of, and might fight in 5 days. Like, that's the kind of night Kevin Holland had. He set up his next fight. And I like what Kevin Holland is doing before this fight, too. Kevin Holland's a really smart businessman, or at least he seems like one on paper, because in every interview we talked about, yes, he was focused on Jacare. Yes, he was focused on Martin Vittori, or Jack Hermanson, but he was always keeping Israel Adesanya's name in his mouth. He was always saying, well, he doesn't want to fight me. He doesn't want to fight me. He doesn't want to fight me. So if he did beat Jacare, which of course he did, one of the most impressive ways you can, he had set up the, oh, well, at least we have beef now. So if Adesanya's talking about me, my name's still going to be in the headline. Like, Kevin Holland did pretty much everything right from not only a fight perspective, but from a promoter's perspective as well. So he is 100% my MVP.
Yeah, I'm with you in terms of how he markets himself. You know, the latching on to Dana White calling him Big Mouth is kind of genius, because if you do, you can say it sarcastically when you're like, Big Mouth wins again, you know, and then it gives you a reference point. It gives you a clip. It continues to show you proving Dana wrong, to constantly bring it up over and over and over again. So I think the kid knows what he's doing. I think he has a good coaching staff around him. I think listen, we've said this about a lot of different guys, but you know, if and I'm not saying Kevin Holland's Israel Adesanya, but some of the things that people said about Adesanya when he was having early success are the same type of things they're saying about Kevin Holland. And listen, a little bit of that's coded language for, you know, when you don't like somebody. The thing I like about guys that talk a lot of shit is that, one, I just like shit talking in general, but two, I think it's like, it makes your opponent dismiss you because this is the narrative that the opponent always takes. He can't be as good as he says he is. Well, no, maybe he's not as good as he says he is, but he's still a handful. And I think that Jose Aldo fell into that with Conor McGregor. Dustin Poirier probably fell into that with Conor McGregor, which is why I'm very interested for this fight coming up next, because just Dustin Poirier isn't walking into the cage thinking he's better than Conor McGregor like he did the first time. And so I think that's going to be interesting. You talked about the announced team. Is there anything else from this fight, from this card that you're taking away? Like, man, I didn't see that coming, but like, I may have changed the way I'm thinking about a guy.
I changed the way I think about Deveson Figueiredo. And again, I'm going to bring it back to Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan said something and I just audibly went in my living room. Well, that's not true. Joe Rogan was like, Deveson Figueiredo is great everywhere. He's good on the feet. He's good on bottom. That's the thing. Deveson Figueiredo is not that good on bottom. Yes, he can scramble. Yes, he is a submission threat. But when you look at the guys that we spot who have success against him, Jared Brooks fought him to a split decision, now no longer in the UFC. Jussie Formiga, of course, beating him. And now looking at Brandon Moreno, who forced a draw. His wrestling is a bit of a weakness moving forward. And again, I'm not saying a lot of guys in this division are going to be able to take advantage of that. But for Deveson Figueiredo, I'm constantly looking at 135. And I'm always thinking, okay, who can get matched up with one at 135? Because I think Dana has a pretty short lease with Figueiredo. I know he's fought twice in 1 month. He just put on a great fight. But when you miss weight in a title fight, that's about the worst thing you can do in the UFC. And I still think Dana White holds like a bit of a grudge against him over that. So if Figueiredo misses weight or has a hard time making weight, I can see the UFC forcing his hand and making a move up to 135. And I can see guys at 135 really exploiting some of the issues we've been starting to see Figueiredo have at 125. But other than that, if that's the worst thing I can say about your performance, you still did pretty good.
Yeah, I think that for Figueiredo, I mean, I don't want to say it's like zero margin for error, but I think that he needs to understand that is a really, really good, really, really young division. So Dana White is like, listen, if this guy's not a star and he's not putting on great fights, I'll force him up to 35. He'll bring who he is with him up to 35. And I still got some stuff down here, 25, a division that I was thinking about getting rid of anyway.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%.
Yeah, so he really needs to keep his mind his P's and Q's. All right, guys. That does it for this podcast. FMP recaps UFC 256 is in the books. It was a long one. We apologize. I mean, it was a good one though. There's a lot to talk about. This fight, this card got, and listen, if you think this one's going to be long, the next one is a loaded card. So that one might be even longer. You might be in for a Joe Rogan podcast lengthwise next time out. Matt, tell folks a couple of things. Tell them where they can follow you and tell them what next week looks like in terms of picks.
All right, so you can find me at Matt Allen FNP on Instagram and on Facebook, or not on Facebook, goodness, on Instagram and on Twitter. I answer a lot of people's questions on there. And then, of course, at Fight Night Picks, we get a lot of great content coming out. Early stoppage, you can see, there we go. You can see John Franklin with the one and only Craig Allen FNP on there. We've got this recap show. We've got the predictions. Craig and I'll be recording those today and tomorrow. Those should be out on Tuesday. We got the long format video. We got This Week in MMA. FNP is starting to blow up. So thank you to all you guys, and let's keep this moving.
There you have it. All right, guys. We'll see you next time out. Peace.